We will not be held responsible for any hearing impairments or damage caused to you from excessive exposure to this sound.
Yeah, we don't want to do anything to scare your children. That's the last thing we want to do. We don't want to scare anybody.
You ready? Here we go.
Once again, we find ourselves in the graveyard of All Saints Church, Sutton Courtenay, and we're sat by Eric Arthur Blair's graveside, otherwise known as George Orwell. On today, the 25th of June 2008, George Orwell's birthday. How old is he today?
105.
We think 105 years old. I am sat with various people that were keen to come down and talk about, well, we've been talking about anything we really want to talk about at the moment. All kinds of bits and bobs, from social media to public spaces, surveillance technology, even the Olympics has come into conversation. And maybe we can once again skim over some of those subjects. So, you know me, I'm Christian Payne of OurManInside.com and Documentally.com. On Twitter, I'm twitter.com/documentally.
And I'm Brian Jones, also known as Star Barista at starbarista.com, as well as East End Eats, just a little food blog. And I am Brian Jones, which is all about me. Yeah.
And I'm John Perry Valaris. I'm a photographer, and I was here last year. I think only Christian and I were here last year. Maybe next year there will be 8 people, and the year after, 16. Oh, and then the hordes.
And I am the northerner, street geek extraordinaire, Phil Campbell from me.dm.
So who wants to kick off? What does what kind of place does Eric Arthur Blair, George Orwell have in our lives today? What kind of images conjure up in your mind when you think of him, and kind of overlay him onto today?
Well, for me, I'm a traveling type person, and always inspired by a lot of his travel writing, particularly his experiences with hop picking and going around the countryside of England, living the life of a hop picker. Really inspired me to go out and travel, I guess. Yeah.
I identify very closely with his paranoia, and I'm in the unfortunate position of actually living out the nightmare he predicted all those years ago.
Do you mean on a surveillance kind of level there?
I think on a surveillance level, but only as part, I think, as a sort of retreat of civil liberties we're experiencing, I think, at the moment, particularly in this country, it seems.
Don't get me started on civil liberties. I mean, you know, we could be here for longer than that can store, to be quite fair. I was reading up quickly about him, because obviously this is not really my field, books and writings and literature. But what did interest me is he did something in Wigan. And I can't believe anybody would want to go to Wigan. So I'm going to read that book.
Yeah, there's so much literature involving, around and written by George Orwell, as he was known.
But wait a minute, he wasn't just a literary person, he was a media person. He was very cutting edge in his day, in that he was one of the people who made best use of radio at the time. In fact, he's buried. We mentioned this last year in front of David Astor, who was the owner, publisher of the Guardian, I think, Observer, at the time. So there he was in the centre of media.
And this is a really, really exciting time to a certain extent for media, because it could be the end of a lot of publications, especially in paper form, as everything starts moving online and bloggers start to be kind of gaining a little bit more respect in the world. I was just talking to Joanna Geary yesterday in Birmingham. She works for the Birmingham Post. And she was saying there's all kinds of positions and new jobs coming up now for people that have that little bit of insight into the internet and how newspapers can successfully and safely kind of make the transition. Do you have a feeling that this is going to give us more truth, more facts, a kind of a closer grip on what's actually going on?
I don't know, possibly. I mean, let's hope so, but let's not confuse information with enlightenment. After all, in 1984, George Orwell writes many, many pages about the Ministry of Information, which is perhaps the most important institution he writes about in that novel. And there, information is used really to oppress people rather than to free them. And I think we're in that position in a way with the new technologies and the internet, in that we've been talking about this. We've had the sort of golden age, which has now passed, when information was freely being produced and distributed, and all kinds of conversations were going on between people who previously would never have had the possibility of being in touch with each other. And now we're entering a new phase, I think, when the internet will be increasingly, it seems, regulated, and regulated by the state, and nationalized, and all those things which we thought the internet was actually freeing us from are beginning to restrict the possibilities of that medium.
Coming from an opposite end of that spectrum, being on into computers and lived practically my whole career and changed many times, I think the more that there is suppression from the government on these technologies, the more you'll see more grassroots grow out of that, because there is no way now to suppress information. I always use this old analogy that it used to be a horse rider to ride on a horseback for 2 weeks to tell somebody that the war was over, whereas now a war can be started and stopped within milliseconds, you know. So the flow of it is changing, the delivery method is changing. I'm not necessarily sure if people are ready for it yet. I think there's going to be a massive digital divide in terms of the people who are information rich and those who are just digitally poor when it comes to actually using the technology. So yeah, I agree, golden age, the next phase, I don't know, very uncertain times for me.
Is there a way out, do you think, in your mind, from the whole privatisation of the net argument? Do you think that when you say grassroots organisations will be kind of cropping up, do you think there is a way for us to bypass the internet that we've become a massive part of now if they do start privatising it?
Well, we'll look at it this way. You know, 20, 25 years ago, the internet wasn't designed for what it does now. A lot of money was pumped into it so that institutions could sell stuff and use it as another broadcast medium and PR and advertising. And it's doing something that it was never really designed to do. So you're sort of chucking money at, you know, an old boat, just fixing it up as you go along. But I think what you're finding is that there's very targeted groups of people who've used it as a catalyst, as an ammo belt, if you like, towards building better things. Will we see different variations and variants of the internet? Yes, we will. Will we, you know, there's elements on the internet that have been there for 30, 40 years using their IRC. They still exist. People still use that communication method. As far as governments, I don't think you can do it now. They've let it go far too long. There's too many off bits that can happen on the internet. I read some stupid statistic. There's like 55 billion web pages on the internet, and if you looked at them, every single one for 4 seconds, it'd take you 5,000 years.
So, for example, if somebody that was supplying us the means, like your cable provider or your fibre optic provider or your ASDL line provider, surely they are far more easily controllable than the internet as such, and we can just, to a certain extent, be limited in access that way by they're talking about the regulation of size of pipe. So, you know, if you are a heavy subscriber, you're going to be allowed this amount of bandwidth.
They tried years ago to put this, you know, slow lane, middle lane, fast lane, a bit like the motorways. You know, I want to talk to somebody in New York and I want the call to be absolutely perfect. You know, I don't want any hang-ups, and I will pay for that connection. Money talks. I mean, at the end of the day, you can buy a high-speed internet. You're talking about regulation in terms of a country, but I could host something on a Taiwanese server that doesn't have those regulations, and you could access that. You would be doing it illegally from the UK, but, you know, people are moving around more than they ever have done in history. There's sheer amounts of populace moving from one continent to another continent. And if a country and a government says, you know, this is how you're going to access the internet, you'll see a large number of people shift, if they can afford to do so, somewhere else where their laws are relaxed. So
we've also got WiMAX playing a big part, hopefully. I mean, I live to a certain extent within the catchment area of the country, the United Kingdom's first ever test of WiMAX, and I really should look into it more and see if I can get on that test group, because I find that fascinating. I do notice my eggs cooking quicker in the morning, whether that's anything to do with the signal strength, but all these, I'd love to look more into packet radio and to see whether or not we can actually effectively exchange data over analog radio waves, just in case. You never know.
I mean, WiMAX, for instance, I think there might be a mini golden age when WiMAX happens, if it happens in the UK, because I know there's been a lot of tests and there's a lot of things not happened. But when it can be spread out over 30 or 40 miles, I think a localised version of that to bring people together in the local area, you might see little areas expanding faster and exponentially more than others because of it. So for me, the geolocation side of it, to actually... I would love, and I've envisaged a time when I'm driving down the road in my car and my dashboard flicks up, you know, there's somebody at the end of this road or someone at the other corner of the road who needs my services, and are you free? You know, so I see it not just being about information, but also fitting into our lifestyles more uniquely.
Now, John, you talk about kind of being in tune with the paranoia talked about by George Orwell, yet you are very keen to be blipping and sending your exact coordinates into the ether from mobile technology and bits and bobs, are you not?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not a you know, anti any of this. On the contrary, I think the internet and all the digital technologies and new media have brought more advantages than disadvantages. But we are coming to the end of that golden age. And one thing George Orwell didn't predict was actually that most of the restrictions and controls wouldn't be coming from the state. I mean, we talk about governments and states, but I think they're largely irrelevant in this, in that this is another one of those issues relating to what is public anymore. And in a globalized world, that's not regulated by states and governments anymore, but by corporations who control these technologies. So I think money talks in more ways than one. And I think it's about capitalism. I keep telling myself this. It's about capitalism, stupid. Not about some Orwellian nightmare of the state, which, after all, in 1984, what he imagined was a tyranny of socialism. And that's something, you know, he couldn't have predicted where we are now, which is the sort of triumph of sort of rampant capitalism and all that means, and the shift away, you know, of power away from the state, away from government. I mean, I'm all in favor of more government, not less. But, you know, the reality is that money talks.
Yeah, definitely. We've had many discussions recently about the restrictions on photography, for example. You may hear some cameras snapping in the background as we... here we go, here we go. Just like that. And as a photographer, have you personally come up with any instances where you are being asked to maybe not take photographs in this place for any particular reason?
Yeah, I mean, a recent example. I was on the canal in London, and I walked past there's a kayaking school, and there were some children learning how to kayak, and I started taking photographs of them, and one of the instructors asked me to stop. And I said, well, no, you're in a public space. I can observe you. I have every right to take photographs here.
Is it because you look a bit like a paedophile?
Oh, definitely.
Well, that's what effectively what he was accusing you of, wasn't he?
I'm not sure he knew what he was accusing me of. He did preface it by saying, I know people are paranoid about this, and he didn't really know why. Yeah. And when I said, you know, I'm standing in a public space, you're in a public space, I can do this, he backed off and he was okay. And then I gave him my card later and he was fine with that. Once he sort of knew that I was a professional, I know this is legitimate, then it was okay. And also he couldn't really do anything.
But, interesting that the question wasn't raised as to whether you were going to be making money from those children's images.
No, it wasn't, no. Well, he was more concerned with... He didn't really want to engage with me anymore. He was more concerned in making sure the kids
saving lives.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm thinking this is happening more and more. I mean, I've had my own experiences of being in places, but it wasn't until John actually mentioned, you know, were these places with maybe a bit of a banking background, were these places of intense corporate activity? And yeah, most of the times they are, even when they're not that heavily incorporated. Yeah. They're shopping centres, for example.
I mean, another example, I just photographed a wedding at the HSBC cricket ground down by Bromley in South London. And I showed up the day before to scout out the location. And it was interesting, the person handling the event said, well, you can take photos here, but make sure you don't get our logo in any of the photos, which I thought was kind of strange, because the whole point of having your logo all around the place is so that it gets in photos. And
so why did they not want affiliation with this event?
I don't know. I think it's lack of knowledge about what photography is about and what it's doing. And there's just this paranoia that people don't really, they feel like they have to be paranoid.
So the fact that the police are providing posters, which I've seen in many, many shops now, stating that if you see a person with a camera, he's probably very dodgy, report him. If you see a person with more than one mobile phone, if you see a person hiring a white van for an unusual reason, we're deemed to be almost subliminally told that maybe these are suspicious people, therefore they must be terrorists. And do you think people's ignorance is just absorbing all of this in? Nodding heads.
Yeah. That works well in audio, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there is a general tone now, not just to do with photographers, but, you know, having a TV license now. The latest campaign, do you remember, was, you know, if you don't have a license, we know about it. And the posters were basically a cityscape. It looked, it could be anywhere. It was probably London. An aerial view, and from the point of view of the person doing the surveillance. So you are being watched. Watch out. And this is carrying across to all kinds of areas, not necessarily to do with terrorism. In fact, mostly not to do with terrorism. It's interesting that where you see the highest concentration of cameras is not really in areas you would consider to be vulnerable to terrorism, but areas where a lot of corporate activity is going on, or residential areas where people working in those sectors live. So, yeah.
You mean CCTV cameras?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the whole thing about CCTV cameras, I've had two crimes committed against me in the last couple of years. And one, I was hit by a car running a red light, and another, my bicycle was stolen, all clearly within view of CCTV cameras. And what did the police do? Absolutely nothing. They didn't even, I mean, supposedly they're there to fight crime and to catch people out, but they can't even be bothered to use them sometimes.
So do you think they're more of a psychological tool than an actual physical...
Oh, definitely. Definitely a psychological tool, because the kids who are doing these things, they've got their hoods up. They can't be identified anyway.
Wait till the new CCTV is out. We'll have X-rays that we can compare later.
But I think the use it's the cart before the horse. The use, how you're going to use these cameras, that question only arises after they're installed. I think it's about money again. It's a huge business. People are being contracted privately by corporations often to install these cameras. This is a huge business.
Then they have to be monitored, of course.
And then the use of them, I think, comes as an afterthought. I mean, how many of these are actually used for some purpose would be an interesting piece of research.
I'd love to see how many crimes are actually solved through the use of CCTV.
I mean, Jean-Charles de Menezes, that wasn't solved by CCTV.
That was almost anti-solved, the way that all the footage was going missing. Yeah. And
talking about the usage of the CCTV on a similar tract, I had a television I bought from an online internet store last year. It went wrong Boxing Day. I sent it back. They replaced the television set within a week. A week later, I had a letter from TV Licensing saying, "We know you've recently just bought a television from eBuyer. You don't have a license on file. You're watching this illegally." The license is actually in my girlfriend's name. But it just shows you how everything is connected. The fact that all I did was replace it under warranty. I didn't actually buy it. But because the warranty had flagged it up on the system, it let them know that I was dealing with a television that had a license attached to it. That didn't exist a year or two ago. Systems did not have that on board.
And it's quite funny listening to American podcasts or American radio shows. They don't talk about our TV license. They say that in the UK, we have a TV tax. We are taxed to watch television, and therefore all of our programmes are so much better because of the amount of money that goes in to pay for that.
That's kind of how the American embassy is portraying the congestion charge in London as well. They claim it's a tax and won't pay it because they're diplomats and they don't have to pay taxes.
Didn't they actually get away with that because of that as well?
No, they haven't yet. No, they're still... Well, they were in a big fight with Ken Livingstone back when he was mayor, but I don't think that's been resolved.
Wow, yeah, that's fascinating. So what do we have planned to do in this year regarding exploring more, especially the public spaces? I think you're involved quite a lot, aren't you, John, with...
Well, I'm generally getting more and more interested in this whole question of public, what is public. I think it's an important debate, and actually, if we started looking at the question, we'd realise actually that we don't have a clear idea of what is public, what is owned by us, and what is owned privately. Increasingly, I think things are being privatised, and I think space is one of them, including the internet.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, public and private spaces now are. There's so many blurry lines between the two. When I park my motorbike in cities, for example, I found out recently from a traffic warden that if there is a visible, obvious extension in the foundations of a building into the pavement so that you can see a kind of border between the pavement and the building, you can park your motorbike there and cover the number plate up so it's not visible to a certain extent, and you will be void of all potential parking fines because of that. But you try and find these spaces, the company, the building or the home stops, and then it's almost the road starts, and then you can get in trouble for blocking a public highway. There just aren't the spaces now.
But traffic control is actually an interesting area to look at when thinking about surveillance, because there have been several high profile cases recently of local councils setting up their cameras or their, you know, systems so that actually they will tend to fine drivers even though they haven't contravened a regulation or a law. It's just set up that way through a system of cameras, road markings, very, very obscure language on signs, and it's all about generating income for the local council. So that's I think a very clear case where it's about the money,
and obviously a lot more investment in some of the technology used on our roads. I know that one of the top companies in the world, Trevello, I don't know if you're aware of this, but they're actually an arms company, and on their website, if you go to have a look, you can click sniper rifles or speed cameras. Speed cameras, designed for saving lives.
Maybe within the year they'll have a combination unit.
Yeah, who knows? Stop or I'll shoot the new camera from Trivet. I shouldn't really mention the name, should I?
A red light camera mounted with a pistol next to it.
You've got three warnings. You've not paid the bill. You're getting sniped.
Along with face recognition technology.
Yeah. Well, you live in London yourself. You live in...
Nottingham.
Yeah, so Brian lives in London. Sean lives in Nottingham.
Derbyshire,
Northamptonshire. So we've all got a pretty varied outlook on all of this. We're seeing things from four different places, but I think Northampton in general is famous for having some of the most high-tech CCTV in the world to a certain extent. They were even sending people over from the States to study some of the technology. Yeah, we had some of the first NPR cameras, a number plate recognition. We've got some incredible stuff now that I have no idea what it is. I really should start photographing these cameras and trying to do a Google image search on them, because they are very weird.
Do they identify themselves, the cameras? Are there any signs saying
no markings,
this is a CCTV camera?
Well, wouldn't that be interesting?
The new generation, I think, of camera has gone away from that idea of being visible now, so that they look, a lot of them look like lampposts or are not visible anymore.
This is because, quite conveniently, a lot of local, I don't want to say NIMBY groups, but the groups that I, to a certain extent, believe a lot of what they're saying are saying, let's reduce the clutter on the road, let's start making things blend in a bit more, which really does... serve one purpose for having maybe covert tax gathering cameras hidden from sight, so there's no way of you being pre-warned for their existence.
Well, that's like saying aesthetics over privacy, isn't it? It looks nice, but you've lost your privacy. Now, it's a weird paradox that all these different things seem to be merging into one unified, you know, oh, it's a CCTV camera, therefore you know you're not going to ever see the footage. We don't know how much is being spent on that equipment. We don't know the benefits, you know. And again, on another side of that, you've got criminal side of things probably looking at these CCTV cameras, know more about the systems than the person in the street, the average person in the street, because they want to know how to circumvent the systems. So there's a lack of communication somewhere along the lines.
Do you think that the miniaturisation of closed circuit television systems and surveillance with the kind of advance we're having in technology is going to affect the kind of panopticon feeling that we're having, this self-imposing?
Well, I think we can kiss privacy goodbye. I think the era of privacy, actually, when you look at it in the big picture, was a very short period of time. I think I'm reconciled to the idea that privacy is coming to an end, and maybe it's not a bad thing. Maybe we shouldn't have privacy, but then if that's the case, then we should all have access to the surveillance equipment. I think it's the problem I have is when it's one-sided. I think if we all had access to the footage being produced, then we might figure out what the usefulness is, and that might actually work better. But that would include being able to carry out surveillance on the people carrying out surveillance on us now. And I think it's a very one-sided relationship. So I think it's unlikely in the near future.
Brian, how do you feel about the possibility of losing privacy, full stop?
I don't think I have any privacy. I don't have any expectation of privacy in public spaces. I do have an expectation of privacy in my own home and in my communications.
Have you heard of the street-level scanners that can monitor people inside their homes?
Thermal cameras?
They're a combination of thermal and millimeter waves, I believe, and they're installed allegedly, apparently. I'm probably reading some of the websites Phil visits now, into lampposts to give a total, visual picture of what's going on inside every house on a street.
Yeah, I'd say that's outside the bounds of acceptability. Just like using a long lens to see. It's the same as using a long lens to see within someone's private property. And that's outside of the realms of acceptability.
But it's happening every day.
Yeah.
As is mobile surveillance through miniature devices, which I think we're only a step away from fly-sized surveillance cameras. The technology is being developed right at this minute.
I've got a friend who quite often mounts sugar cube size colour Wi-Fi CCTV cameras on radio controlled aircraft and flies them through goggles. If he's doing that for less than a couple of £100, I imagine there's a lot more out there. Do you feel you have any privacy left, Phil?
I probably lost privacy or faith in any types of what I perceive my privacy to have been probably about 15, 20 years ago when I first got onto the internet, when I started to realise that there was a whole subset of people that would sit on a computer for 8 or 10 hours a day. And if a normal everyday person could do that, then what could an organised group of individuals, you know, that were paid by either a corporation or a government do with some kind of lead and some kind of potential to be put onto a particular topic or whatever. So I think a lot of it came out of gaming. I started playing games against people across the world and started to realise there was a whole subset of people that just wanted to communicate and talk. And with that comes the lack of controls. You know, when you're surfing from one country and one continent and it's completely transparent, how can you possibly have any privacy? You know, we're not talking through two metal cans with a piece of string where you have just two people involved in that conversation. You're travelling through pipes, and there's something happened to us when we wanted all the options. We just gave in our rights to any sort of privacy because we wanted that technology. Technology has almost overwritten privacy because we don't care about where our information leaves from our computer. I might be sending a file from the UK to a server in America, but it has to travel through tubes to get there. And there's no, you know, we don't get educated in school of how the internet works. We just get told the internet works. We don't get shown how it works.
Is there any defence in data saturation as such? A lot of people involved in social networking are putting so much information out there.
I'm all for transparency. I said it earlier on before we were talking on the podcast. I've managed to connect with people who I need to trust somebody in this world before I can call them a friend or an associate or an employee or somebody I can work with. I need to be able to trust them enough to be able to complete what they've asked me to do. The noise factor of social media. Look, 10 years from now, data information will double every 72 hours. Try and think of that concept. Try and put that into context.
Beyond my comprehension.
How can you put attached privacy to that? You know, the sheer amount and scale of data and information that will be shared globally between people, between companies, is going to be so huge. How can the current infrastructure of legislations from government cope with something like that? It's impossible. You know, and these data farming places all around the world that are listening stations to this information, they have to scale as well. You know, the memory and the costs of memory that will be involved with storing that type of information, be it from, you know, government agencies to regulate defence networks. You know, you've got to think of the scale of this. It's just going exponential day by day.
Are we going to be more free in the future or less free?
I think you need to tap into a group of people who see things the way that you do and feel comfortable in that group. I don't necessarily know if that means we will have more access, more freedom in the future, but all I can say is keep it localized, make connections, tap into people who see things the way that you see them.
I think we can be free, but I think the path to that is to making these spaces where we transact our relationships and commercial relationships, personal relationships, have to be completely transparent and completely public. Because I think all the problems that emerge, criminal activity, invasion of privacy, only take place because the perpetrators have privacy. And it's one-sided. You don't, they do. But if everybody within that space has to be in the open, out in the open, then I think you reduce a lot of those problems. So I'm, you know, for more, less privacy, more public, more transparent public space.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of look at the internet and these social networks like, you know, kind of an expansion of a cafe or a town square. I mean, if you're in those places, you are going to be careful what you're going to say, because you might be saying something that you don't want people to hear. I mean, you're out there in public and you have to be careful. Treat it like a public space. And if you don't want someone to hear something, don't say it.
Two sentences that have really stuck in my mind from the conversation, which one may become a tagline: kiss privacy goodbye, and let's be careful out there. Oh, thanks a lot, guys. Yes. And we've already sung happy birthday earlier on,
indeed.
Didn't we?
Yes,
so
indeed.
I'll just raise a glass to George. In this case, a bottle of finest water.
To George.
George. Cheers. Cheers. Happy birthday, George Orwell. Thanks for listening. You're listening to an OurManInside.com podcast. Used to be called Documentally.com. It's all converging.
Walk away from there, okay?